Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal net neutrality rules adopted a few years ago under the Obama administration. The rules had not yet got into effect, but would have followed the principle that all web traffic be treated equally. Without net neutrality rules in place, internet service providers such as Verizon and AT&T have leeway to slow or block websites and apps and charge more for faster speeds. Clint Finley is a writer at Wired, where he covers net neutrality and technology policy. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Clint.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does this mean for everyday people?
Well, it's too early to say exactly what it's going to mean, but it's probably not going to be great in the long term. So some of the things that could happen, we might see internet service providers charging more for people to access something like Netflix. We don't know if they'll end up charging Netflix more to reach consumers, so people's Netflix bills will go up, or if it'll be more on the consumer end, where you choose different tiers of service depending on how much video you want to watch or what types of video providers you want to access. So that's one very clear possibility that we might see from companies like Charter and Comcast in the near future. By the near future, I mean in the next few years. It probably won't be. We probably won't see big radical changes in the next year. So beyond just service and pricing increases, the problem with these ideas of creating essentially fast lanes or slow lanes that companies or consumers pay extra for to access particular content is it's going to make life harder for smaller providers. So, Netflix might be able to afford this. Consumers might be willing to pony out a little bit more money so that they can keep watching Stranger Things, but it's going to be harder to convince people to pay extra for new services from new companies, or for new companies to get the funding to compete in these areas. So we'll probably see lots of innovation in new companies.
So you're saying we will see new innovation in new companies? Or
we'll see less innovation because it'll be harder to build a business on the internet.
And yet, when you hear from the folks at the FCC who supported repealing these rules, they say that is precisely why they're doing it, because the big companies are saying it would affect innovation from where they sit.
Right. The companies like Comcast and Charter say that they need the rules to go away so they can create innovative new plans for people to buy internet. But, so far the innovations they're talking about are the things I mentioned, like charging different amounts of money for different plans. So there is one possible outcome here, which is that, you end up paying for a smaller plan that only lets you access Facebook or something. It probably wouldn't be that restrictive, but you would pay to access just a few things, and maybe your bill actually goes down because you don't watch a lot of video or you don't, use a lot of different particular websites. So there's some possibilities there. But then again, that'll make it a lot harder for new sites, new services to reach people. So that in the end, innovation is harmed.
The FCC has embraced net neutrality for more than a decade and adopted the rules to that effect in 2015. The rules never actually went into effect, right?
No, they did go into effect. Rules that haven't gone into effect is the new thing that was passed last week that will overturn the old rules.
Okay.
So those rules did actually go into the Obama era rules did go into effect in mid 2015.
And what did those rules do? I mean, what exactly did the rules say that were repealed?
A few things. So the big things were that internet service providers, that's both mobile providers like AT&T and Verizon, and cable and home internet providers like Comcast and Charter, that those companies can't block lawful content. So if it's something illegal, they can still block you from accessing it. But anything that's legal, they can't block it. They can't throttle it or slow it down deliberately. If the website is just slow because on their end, there's nothing that the ISPs can do about it, but they can't deliberately make something slower. And they can't engage in paid prioritization, which is the fast lane stuff that I was talking about.
And so if I'm getting on the internet and I want to Google something, what pops up will be different or could be different under these new rules or these in the repealed era?
In the repealed era, you know, your Google results might be the same, but then when you try to click through to get to the page,
okay,
you might not be able to access it, or it might load more slowly if you don't pay extra.
Okay. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Wired reporter Clint Finley about the vote last week at the Federal Communications Commission to repeal net neutrality rules. They've been in place. They went into effect they were put in place in 2015. They were rolled back now. The fight over net neutrality isn't over, though. Some advocacy groups are planning lawsuits. What are they shooting for, Clint?
So there's a couple different approaches here, but one of the big ones is just to have the new repeal order thrown out on legal grounds. So it's against federal law for federal agencies to pass arbitrary and capricious laws. So because the original set of net neutrality rules from 2015 mm-hmm. are not even 3 years old yet, and they're already being repealed, the case that the lawyers are going to argue that this is an arbitrary and capricious decision on the FCC's part, that this is going to be harmful to industry because the rules are yo-yoing back between administrations. So then the FCC is going to argue that the rules need to be repealed because they hurt investment in broadband infrastructure. And the evidence is pretty thin there, as I've written about, but in a lot of cases, the courts will just defer to the federal agency if they say, you know, if they say the facts are these, they'll defer to the agency and not to the organization suing the agency. So we'll have to wait and see what happens.
What is when they say that the rules would affect broadband investment in broadband infrastructure? Is the point there that they wouldn't be able to make as much money on the other end, and then therefore they would invest less in infrastructure?
Right. Yeah. So they're worried that that these companies will spend more time, will make less money because they can't do the things I mentioned, mm-hmm. the charge for faster priority access, which they've for the most part never really been able to do. So it's not like they're going to lose a revenue stream there that they already had. Then there's also concerns that the rules had some more overbroad features to them that would ultimately end up hurting broadband companies, though, you know, those had never really been brought to bear. So it's fairly speculative on that side, but just about everything in this debate is speculative, to be honest.
Hmm. Some groups are pushing Congress to overturn the FCC's decision. Can Congress do that? I mean, what are they shooting for there?
Yeah, there's something called the Congressional Review Act that allows Congress to completely throw out an agency's rulemaking decision and effectively bar them from ever passing a similar decision ever again without Congress's permission. So mm-hmm. Congress actually did this earlier this year to the Obama-era FCC internet privacy rules, the ones against broadband companies selling your personal data without your permission. Congress reversed that decision to actually allow companies to sell your data earlier this year. And that was not a particularly popular decision. So activist groups and a few Democrats are hoping to kind of seize on that earlier political misstep and pressure Republicans into signing on to a decision to reverse the net neutrality order as well.
Wired reported that the FCC's public comment period on the repeal of net neutrality protections was bombarded with bops and memes and input from people who don't actually exist. Did anyone look into this?
The Attorney General in New York is has an ongoing investigation that he has accused the FCC of not cooperating with.
On that issue.
Right. With that investigation.
Did it affect the timeline of the vote, this interference online? Ironically?
No, it didn't. Okay. Yeah, the Attorney General, the New York Attorney General, had asked the FCC to delay the vote, and several senators and congresspeople, including a few Republicans, had asked for a delay in the vote while the investigation was conducted. But the FCC ultimately decided to just move forward with the vote.
Now, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, the biggies, they've promised not to block or throttle content. Isn't their word good enough?
Well, the thing is that they could always change their mind. And what they, for the most part, are not promising, they're not promising not to do paid prioritization or fast lanes.
Mm-hmm.
So the blocking and throttling is a little less likely for them to engage in something as blatant as that anytime soon. And in this case, I think they, by throttling, they mean like really obvious slowing down of content. So what we might expect to see is more subtle ways of trying to influence what you see online.
There are state-level laws to protect net neutrality. Some states have taken up lawsuits. The Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine has just announced that Ohio will not be one of those states. What's the likelihood of them succeeding, in their pursuits?
Well, one of the things in the new FCC order, the one that repeals the net neutrality rules, is also a state preemption clause, which means that the FCC wants to have their rules take precedence over any state rules. So essentially, they want to shoot down state net neutrality laws before they even happen at the federal level. So we'll see. That's something else that'll have to go to court and see whether it survives. And then there's also, so I don't know of any net neutrality rules currently on the books, but both Washington State and a state senator in California have announced plans to put together some sort of state level net neutrality protections in those states.
Mm-hmm.
And in Washington, in particular, it looks like they're trying to find ways to dance around the FCC's restrictions. So instead of having explicit net neutrality rules that all internet service providers have to follow, what they're trying to do is just make life very difficult for companies that don't put net neutrality into their contracts by denying them state contracts, removing state tax subsidies, or changing or making it more difficult for them to do things like access utility poles to string cables. Probably zoning for cell towers would end up being affected too. So doing those sorts of things to push companies to essentially follow net neutrality rules without actually making it a law. So we'll see if that holds up.
There was a lot of criticism over the past couple of weeks that the media was not covering this. Now, that certainly wasn't Wired's problem, but what is your, that people were just completely unaware. There were a lot of protests out there by media, or I should say tech-savvy people who were protesting in Washington and elsewhere. But what is your sense about the larger understanding in this and about how the media covered it?
Well, it's hard to say. On the one hand, this is an issue that's been around for more than a decade, and it had been a pretty quiet, technical, wonky debate, and it's gotten a lot more mainstream attention this year than it ever has previously, even in 2014, when the last time it was a big deal in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, the mainstream media has given it a lot more attention than it ever has before. On the other hand, it didn't give it as much attention as some other issues, but there's such big issues in the news right now, that the tax overhaul plan in particular, it's easy for some of the smaller stuff like net neutrality to get drowned out with so much activity happening in the White House and Congress.
Except that net neutrality will really affect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it has an effect on how people find out about everything else. If news companies have a harder time getting their video content across, mm-hmm. For example, have a harder time getting their content across than the content owned by companies like Verizon and AT&T, then yeah, it's gonna affect people's access to information and access to news.
Is there any protections for media for censorship by those companies that control the web in that way? Is there any way to restrict them?
Well, no, not really. That's kind of what net neutrality was the essentially the First Amendment for the internet, saying that internet service providers couldn't, you know, censor or discriminate against particular content, and that includes news content. And with that going away, that's there won't be much of a way to hold those companies accountable, and unless Congress passes some new net neutrality rules. And that's the other new frontier to this, is even if Congress doesn't repeal or reverse the FCC's decision, they can create new net neutrality laws that the, say, the Federal Trade Commission has to enforce.
Clint Finley, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I hope it wasn't too confusing.
No, not at all. Clint Finley, reporter at Wired. We'll have a link to his latest articles on the decision by the FCC last week to repeal the rule of net neutrality in the United States. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. By next week, families will be tinkering with a host of new gadgets and apps. Many parents will be grappling with the very technology they have gifted to their young children for Hanukkah or Christmas. We want to help. Joining us by phone is editor of the Children's Technology Review, Warren Buchleitner. Welcome back, Warren.
It's good to be with you, Ann.
So one of the most popular gifts, Google Home and Amazon Echo, they follow voice commands, which means that they are always listening. And that has some parents concerned, right? Why are they worried?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think they're great gifts. And you can get into both platforms for $20, $30. I think $30 for the Echo Dot, and mm-hmm. Google Home has a $30 option. And they are amazing, what they can do. Yeah, there's good news. There's the optimist point of view on these and the pessimist point of view on these. And so, I was promising to continue my strain of pessimism based on the net neutrality conversation I was listening to with fascination.
So what's the bad? What are they worried about?
Well, I mean, I think you have to always, the parent of today, the modern parent, needs to be aware that there are three supercomputers always listening to your voice, and Google, Apple, and Amazon, and at least in my home. And so, if you say the word Alexa, it's proof. It responds, and that information is being broadcast over a wireless signal, which is basically a radio signal, and that could be picked up in theory. And all these things are sort of theoretical, but the information that you say into it is being tracked, and algorithms are sort of keeping track of what you ask, and including what your children ask. So in a sense, if you're really paranoid these days, you have some things that you could really be, have valid concerns about, and some people are. And as this technology finds its way into toys, it's kind of like, wow, I'm putting a corporate entity into my child's playroom. So I think it's important to understand what's going on.
Are you recommending it for a child's playroom?
Yeah, I mean, I'm recommending that parents, what I'm saying is, unless you're on the front page of a newspaper or a celebrity, or if you have a cloud of paparazzi around you, probably not. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of us, I don't think there is a valid concern. I don't think we need to move off the grid and, you know, raise our kids that way. I think it's important. You know, these technologies aren't going to go away, and I think they're part of the new literacy. So I know the way I've personally approached it, and I think that's kind of a question we all have to make these days, is how personally do we use these technologies and, you know, help our children learn what they can and can't do.
How do you recommend using this kind of interactive technology, with the child? I mean, what are some of the best ways it's being used for children?
Well, both Google and Amazon have skills, or, you know, you can think of them as apps that are designed for their devices for children and for families. There's trivia games. There's some really fun sort of quizzes. You can practice a language. When a child is using a voice-driven computing device, it forces them to articulate, and that's a really great skill. You know, verbal skills are something that's not often doesn't creep into the formal curriculum, but you know, the device simply won't respond unless you articulate clearly. And so that's really a strong, you can look at it as a strong literacy skill. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, you ask, you know, what's the best approach? I think you should play with it. I had a lot of fun playing with both Amazon and Google's product. And I actually think Google's is a little bit better in terms of how it responds. And I particularly like the music on Google, the Google Home option. They're both amazing. And I think it's important to, you know, for adults and children and senior citizens as well to play with this new kind of computing.
How much can you control them to make sure that they are age appropriate?
Well, that's a great question, Ann. I think the thing that every parent needs to do is just ignore all the rules and ratings and everything and just try out a few things yourself. For example, when I was trying out the new Facebook Messenger, the first thing I did is typed in a few swear words just to see if it was filtered. And, you know, I think if you're not going to test the limits, your kids certainly will. And if you're not comfortable with that, then, you know, at least you know what you're getting into. But these are sort of generic home devices. They're not designed for one age or another. And what's kind of fun about them is the way even preschoolers will use Amazon Echo, and, you know, they'll learn how to say Alexa, and it's pretty cool the way they do it.
But is there any way to control what they're ordering on Amazon Echo? Is there any way to control what arrives in the mail, or, you know, what the UPS guy brings you?
Yeah. You can have a conversation with your child.
You could.
And be very smart about it. Google actually has a mute button, and you can, you know, physical mute button on the front, and you can deactivate it, and I give them credit for that. yes, all of these things have preferences, and I would explore the app that comes with each device. And, you know, you basically set it up with your tablet or your phone, and then you, you know, there are preferences in there. I'm not seeing a lot to worry about other than the fact that my mother-in-law and father-in-law accidentally ordered like 48 rolls of packages of toilet paper from Amazon, and they thought they were going to get 48 rolls, and that was kind of a funny thing.
Because, how many did they get?
Well, let's just say we all were gifted for a while. Had no problem.
Well, you always need it, so, you know.
Amazon Prime is basically hardwired into an Echo. If you wonder why these things are cheap right now, there's a battle going on between Google and, you know, other voice driven devices to be that portal into your home.
Changing times. Let's talk about some apps. Facebook recently released an app aimed at children. It's called Facebook Messenger Kids. Is that what you were just talking about?
Yeah, and I'm really excited about it. I think Facebook technology is powerful and easy to use and, in quotations with their last conversation, free, right? It also is COPPA compliant, meaning that, you know, it's able to be used legally for even preschoolers. And it has all of these fun filters so that you can, a child can send a message to their parent and put a mask on and that kind of thing. It's in like 30 languages, you know, so that it's got powerful technology behind it. And today, really none of the kid-specific messaging services have met my criteria for being, you know, just plain and simple, easy to use, and powerful enough. So the thing about it is when your child starts contributing videos and pictures, that goes into your Facebook account. And of course, we all know Facebook owns that content and can use it for their algorithms as well. So it's a great way for Facebook to start harvesting information earlier about your family.
There is this Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act compliant app. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, that's COPPA. Yeah, COPPA, which is what every company, you know, every service has been dancing around. It's a law that was passed, I think during the Clinton administration, at the dawn of the internet, to make sure that any service that's designed for specifically for children is follows guidelines about how the information is used and how their identity is used. And that's why things like YouTube Kids are, you know, didn't come out for so long. This is a very strident law, and if you can't meet it, you get fined. And so a lot of publishers have worried about that. Facebook gets around it because you've already granted them all the rights by opening an account, and you're granting your child, so you're the one doing the government's work in this regard. So you as a parent have the control.
Another app you wanted to talk about used augmented reality. It's called Fieta Cats AR, I guess.
Yeah, it's called Fieta.
Fieta,
it's a German company. Yeah. Yeah, I think this is an important app. Augmented reality is really exploding in the kids space and in general. And of course, that's when you point your camera at something and you see the real room around you that you're in right now. So that's reality. And what the app does is it puts a kitty cat, a computer generated image over that reality. And what Apple's new ARKit plugin has done for developers is it lets their objects respond so that they actually have depth perception. So the cat, in this case, it's called Deepest Cat AR. It just came out. It's a $2 app for iPad and iPhone only. The cat will jump on a table, and you know, you basically have a pet cat and you're running around your house. It's a cheap way to get a cat, and you know, you don't have to feed it too much. There is virtual food and all that. It's not the best app, but it is it does the job. It's very simple. There's no, you know, gimmicks involved with it. And I think that we all need to get smart on AR because, you know, if you haven't tried it yet, make sure you understand what it is. At least stay a step ahead of your kids on this one.
Okay. By the way, is there a virtual litter box?
There actually is, yes.
They've thought of everything.
And you don't have to clean it.
Okay.
Which is really good.
Another app you wanted to talk about is a music app called Bandimal. So in this app, users make music with animals. All right. Is this like the barking dogs doing jingle bells?
Kind of like that. The animals are animated and they move in a very carefully prescribed way, so you can actually follow along and play copycat with them. You should know, I mean, this is one of these hidden treasures in the App Store. It's called Bandimal. So I'll say the title really carefully. It's Band, like B-A-N-D, and then I-M-A-L, Bandimal. And it's from an artist in Italy, Luca Zanato, who's a musical genius. And what he's done is he also did Mixamal, and there's like five of them apps that he's done. So when I saw Bandimal, if you haven't downloaded any of Lucas's app, check them out. They're really good for preschool, preschool, kindergarten, first grade, really up through elementary. In this case, it's like a DJ. You know, you can let your preschooler be a DJ with a musical sandbox, which everything you touch does something and is very responsive. And these animals sort of move 8 beats to a bar, and your kids start understanding pitch, rhythm, and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
I was really excited to find this app.
Well, let's hear a clip of some of the music created with Bandimal. So what are we hearing there?
How did you do that? That was great.
I don't know.
I was thinking I was going to provide that clip. yeah, so what you heard is, you know, if you're a mixer, you know that there's a rhythm track, a bass track, and each animal does something. There's a whale that does a really great sort of low sound. And you can, you know, turn them on and off. And just doing that, you know, that additive process is pretty cool. And, you know, so you heard about four layers there. But what you can also change the pitch and do some subtle things like add echo effects. The interface is very interesting with this particular app because it's like an interface I've never seen before. I initially was thinking it wasn't a very good app because it's so hard to use. But what I realized is it introduces you to this space that everything you do, you can undo. So you start, pretty soon you have a really cool sound going. And you can save the sound, and as you probably did, you can export it. So that's kind of neat too. So even though it's for preschoolers, professional musicians might get a kick out of using this.
And there's also some math involved, as there always is with music, but is it obvious? Is it painfully obvious to a kid trying to avoid math?
Well, it is to me. That's why I love these things. You know, when you hand your child a mix board that, you know, would have cost $20,000 from 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of power, and just say, hey, fool around with it. They'll discover rhythm, you know, you can't spell the word rhythm, but you can know what it is. And even young preschoolers can start fooling around with these ideas. And children who have a musical inclination, this is perfect for them because they don't even understand yet that, you know, why they like something. But this is not a watered down experience. It's powerful. It's easy to use. And this is the kind of, you know, I always try to tell you about products that are worth the price of the tablet, and this mm-hmm. is one of those apps.
Okay. Warren Buchleitner, thank you so much for joining us as usual. Really appreciate your insights.
Happy holidays to everybody on your show, Ann. It's always good talking with you.
Thanks, Warren. It's Warren Buchleitner. He's editor of the Children's Technology Review. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Smart speakers are expected to be a popular gift this holiday season. Google has just released a new high-end version called Google Home Max. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Hi, Russell.
Hello.
So this new Google Home speaker, it's bigger, much bigger, and what does it look like?
Yeah, so it's considerably larger. It's really, it would take up, you know, probably six or seven large books worth of space on your average bookshelf, as opposed to what we've seen from, you know, the Amazon Echo and the original Google Home speakers, which aren't too much bigger than like a thermos as far as the amount of space that they take up. This is designed to not only take up much more space and look like a proper speaker in your house, but it produces an incredible amount of sound by comparison.
So it's worth the extra space.
It's definitely significantly louder without adding distortion or anything like that. This is Google, you know, instead of competing directly with Amazon, they're competing more with Sonos, which has been kind of the high-end sort of smart speaker company for a long time, without having things like Alexa built in or the Google Assistant. They've just been, you know, kind of app-driven and plugged into a bunch of different services.
There is an artificial intelligence enhanced smart sound feature. What does that do? Is it noticeable, or what's the impact of that?
So the whole idea here is that the speakers will adjust slightly based on the room that you have it in. Over time, it uses the microphones that are built into it. If it notices more echo coming from maybe the left side of the room as it's playing music, it will adjust how the sound is coming out of those speakers to address that, so that over a short period of time, say a week or so, the speakers will actually, in theory, sound better than they did when you first set it up.
Interesting. Do you know, like, what the curve is on that for these speakers?
It hasn't, you know, it's something we've been testing for 2 weeks now to try and figure out what the extremes are. And it seems to struggle a little more in much larger rooms, kind of like auditorium size, which you would expect, you know, because it's very hard to compensate for kind of large echoey spaces. But if you have a room where it's, you know, the speaker is up against the wall, there's a reasonable chance that you're not going to have to worry about, you know, bass vibrations, you know, shaking something off the wall or something like that.
How important is the quality of the microphones and devices like these? So we're not just talking about speakers, it's the microphones as well.
Right. And the microphones in these are incredibly important, especially the louder you get, because if you have something that's, you know, the size of an Amazon Echo and it's able to fill an entire room with sound, it still needs to be able to hear you when you want it to pause music or to change tracks or something like that. So the louder the speaker is, the harder that gets. And the testing that we've done so far with this speaker has been really positive. You know, even with the volume up loud enough that from across the room, I could not hear the other person speaking clearly enough to know what it was that was said until the Google Home picked it up and kind of repeated it. The microphone seemed to, you know, once it learns your voice, be very good at picking it up, you know, amid the music that it is playing.
Wow. How much does it cost?
These are $400 speakers. They're $399 speakers that are available. And like I said, they're priced very competitively with the Sonos line of speakers and do everything that a normal Google Home would do. So, you know, connects to your phone, lets you, you know, play music from a bunch of different sources. But it is a very large and very expensive speaker.
Hmm. Apple released a new iMac desktop this last week, and just for people who haven't used, and I haven't used a Mac in a gazillion years, so I know you have. But what's the deal with the Macs?
So these in particular, iMacs are kind of a special breed of Mac computer in that they're designed to be an all-in-one computer. You have the monitor, and that's it. You don't have a separate, you know, piece of hardware for a tower or anything like that. The entire computer lives behind the monitor and in this kind of dome shape attached to the screen. And it doesn't separate. You know, it's an entire sealed experience. Mm-hmm. And so you have just the monitor, the keyboard, and either a mouse or a trackpad, depending on what you want. And that's been the iMac experience for a while now. But it's always been kind of aimed at consumers, not a whole lot for people who are doing graphic design or anything like that. The processor and the graphics card inside of these because they are so close to the screen and because there's a limit to how much heat can be generated behind a screen, they just have never really been designed for professional use. Mm-hmm. And so the iMac Pro is an effort to change that, to create a series of these all-in-one machines that are capable of a lot of computational power for engineers and graphic designers and game developers and things like that, so that they can have this kind of contained experience that they don't have to think about upgrading and controlling all of the different hardware inside.
So if your kid comes home from school someday and says, I need an iMac Pro, you can tell them, get a job.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, these are designed, intentionally to be, let's say the offices at Pixar or something like that. This isn't something that most people are going to need, much less want in their home.
Well, so what's the market for it then?
Well, that's the thing. You know, Apple has always had a significant pro audience, people who do this kind of graphic design work in large batches where the company wants the entire office full of graphic designers to have these high-end computers to work on. And it's important for those computers to be as similar as possible so that when you need to work on them, you can work on them all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's difficult to do in a lot of environments. But Apple makes that very easy because their hardware profiles are always identical across lines.
Okay.
So, for a large company to buy 10 of these would be easy to administer, basically.
How much do they cost?
They are very close to $5,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, they are very, very expensive computers. And there has been a lot of feedback from the very people that Apple is trying to sell these to that you can't actually upgrade some of the internal things on your own. So let's say you wanted to upgrade the RAM over time. You'd actually have to take it to Apple to get that upgrade done instead of doing it yourself. And so that's actually had something of a negative reaction so far among people who would even consider buying these in the first place.
So that's what the main thing people should know if they're interested in getting something like this.
Yeah, they are. They absolutely do the job right now. But if you wanted to have something that you could upgrade over time, you are going to be taking it back to Apple and paying them to do it.
Wow. $5,000, man. You wanted to talk about a way to bring virtual reality experiences anywhere you go. And we're talking about backpacks. This is a thing.
This is the silliest thing. I love this. So there have been for across this year, really since early last year, there have been companies who thought that the way to make virtual reality headsets, quote unquote, wireless, was to design the computer in such a way that you could just wear it on your back, so that you have this, almost like a Ghostbuster style proton pack on your back, and you put the headset on over top of this, and so this is kind of very absurd look to it. And HP is the only company who has taken that idea and tried to make it as practical as possible, as well as, serving this virtual reality need. And it's called the Omen X Compact Desktop. And this is, a traditional desktop in this very thin, very well-ventilated package that has a dock that you set it in, almost like a laptop dock that you set it in. And so you can connect it to a monitor and a mouse and keyboard. And if you want to just pick that desktop up and move it to another dock, say in another office or at home, you have this laptop-sized machine that you can then just pick up and move, and it has its own battery inside, so that you can effectively do that. So it's kind of this practical thing for people who want to be able to take their entire computer from maybe the office to the home, in order to keep working, but they don't really want the laptop feel. They want that kind of desktop power. But since they were already making this thing portable and they were already making it battery powered, they also have this backpack rig that you can connect it to that allows you to attach other batteries to the side so that you can put a virtual reality headset on and play entirely untethered, because it's all running from your back for up to 2 hours. With this, this really kind of crazy looking backpack on.
Yeah, but you don't want to be wandering around with virtual reality, do you?
Well, with a lot of virtual reality headsets that are designed for desktops, they actually have these kind of virtual boundaries.
And right. As
part of the virtual boundary, it lets you know when you're like coming close to walking into something. So this is an alternative to having that cord running from the desktop that you could potentially trip on or step on or anything like that. It removes that cable. But in exchange adds, close to 10 pounds of weight to your back.
Yeah. Have you tried it?
I have tried it. And
of course.
It is, yeah, it's a very silly thing. This is something that you're only really going to be interested in if you are very, very excited about virtual reality things and you want a desktop style computer that is very portable. But it was very interesting to me that HP worked really hard to make it seem like this backpack computer had an almost practical use to it as well.
How much does, well, all right, first of all, the backpack sold separately?
The backpack is sold separately
because,
yeah, it's a separate thing for, I think for $500, it comes with two massive batteries that come with it. But the desktop itself starts at $2,500.
Oh, it's not cheap.
It's not cheap, but you could get two of these instead of getting the iMac.
Good point. Good point. Well taken. And you're a VR lover.
Yeah, this is a very exciting thing, but I'm still not a huge fan of the idea of wearing a computer on your back while doing virtual reality things, just because having that extra weight on your back is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Especially if you go to use it, you know, for any length of time. But it does kind of present in a larger fashion that a big thing we're probably going to see moving into 2018 is a push to remove that big wire that connects the computer to the virtual reality headset.
That's nice. Yeah, but having the headset and the backpack on, I can see it now that I've tried virtual reality. I'm so experienced now it would seem kind of, I don't know, too much. But
yeah, it's a little much if you're planning on doing it for any kind of extended period of time. Once you do reach like 20 minutes, you're probably going to be kind of uncomfortable.
Okay. All right. Did we talk about, yeah, we did talk about cost. Two for the price of one. Okay. You wanted to talk about the Sphero Mini. We've talked about the Sphero Mini before, but I'm glad you brought it up because I saw one in Target the other day and looked at it and went through sticker shock again. But, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, so it occurred to me that this kind of last minute stocking stuffer thing for people who are still not really sure what to get somebody, or they wanted to get somebody something that that pretty much anybody would enjoy. This thing looks like a ping pong ball. It does not look like something that you would spend $50 on, but it is a ping pong ball that has a very capable robot inside that you can drive with your phone. And as part of this experience, the team at Sphero have actually built this entire education platform around it, where you can actually use it as a way to help teach the fundamentals of programming to kids.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a bunch of different applications for this thing, but it is also, and I can't stress enough how important this is, a little ping pong ball with a robot inside that you can chase your cat around with.
That's, I know you, yeah, you're right. I mean, you can't overemphasize that.
And that is really one of my favorite things about little robots the size of ping pong balls, is that the cat really feels like it can play with it right until it starts moving around.
Uh-huh.
And then it just has no idea what to do.
Did the cat jump up in the air and do one of their weird cat things?
No, it tried to bat it. And when it bat it, there's a special button that you can hit that causes the robot to just like slam full power in one direction. And so I did that. And then the cat darted off as soon as it started moving.
You could, we've only got a few seconds left, but you can drive the robot with your face. How does that work?
With your phone. No, you use
your phone. Okay.
To drive the whole thing.
Okay. Got it. That was a misprint then. Note to producers. Russell Holly, thank you so much for all your suggestions for holiday gifts this year. They're great as usual. Really appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.